And the more irreversible the harm is, the more it's appropriate to regulate. In the very next executive order, it talks about you can do open source, but you really don't have to give away proprietary information. When I think of AI governance, it's people, policies, and processes. That's generally governance. That's how the Oxford Handbook on Governance defines governance. I am against it because states are sovereign entities in that there are things that they have to take care of for themselves. They have to be able to run their school systems. They have to be able to run their traffic lights. They have to be able to run their emergency response vehicles and systems. And AI shows up. There is one area where, as a company, you get to decide what gets in your doors, and that is procurement. And if you don't want the bad stuff to come in, then you catch it at procurement.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to Regulating AI, the podcast that brings together global voices to shape the future of artificial intelligence governance. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we have the privilege of speaking with someone who sits at the fascinating intersection of AI policy, procurement, and workplace transformation. Dr. Carrie Miller is with us. She's a globally recognized thought leader in AI governance and procurement practice. She serves as the head of AI governance and policy at the Center of Inclusive Change, and she's also the executive director of the AI Procurement Lab. Carrie has over 25 years of experience in corporate strategy and change management, bringing a unique perspective to the topic of AI governance, one that really combines her deep technical understanding with practical implementation experience and expertise. Having said all of that, Carrie, welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. It's wonderful to have you with us today.
What a great day to be talking with you, sir.
Yes, it is. Carrie, just to give you some perspective, we have a global audience. These are people who are policymakers, members of Congress, Senate, policy leaders around the world. These are people who are interested in policy. These are people who are interested in AI and AI experts. And as I said, it's a global audience, but very interested in what also happens in Washington, where I happen to be. And we had something happen in Washington. The White House announced an action plan on AI. So given that we had an AI executive order from the Biden administration, now 6 months into this administration, now we have what I would say is one of the first major pronouncements coming from there. So why don't you walk our audience through what was announced yesterday and give us some of your opinion on how does it shake out?
Yeah, it was. So it's a long time coming. We were expecting this. So fundamentally, it has three pillars. The first pillar is about innovation. The second pillar is about infrastructure. And the third pillar is about international diplomacy, really. And so the second pillar is the easiest one, I think, for everybody to understand. And that is infrastructure, which, you know, every country around the globe, I think, is clamoring to build out their energy supply and support AI in the best way they can. And so that was all very expected, I think, what can be found in their data centers. And there's a corresponding executive order that goes along with that. There are some interesting things in that executive order, uses of federal land to do these things, shortening permitting processes, and kind of maybe breezing past some usual where you would like test water and do things like that. But anyway, they want to expedite getting that infrastructure in place. So that's the impetus of pillar two. Pillars one and three they got my attention. And so basically I'm going to do pillar three first because pillar one is the zinger, in my opinion. Pillar three is about being a global leader. Obviously, every country wants to be a global leader in AI, right? Especially the US. And so in order to do that, they want to create their AI and they want it to be distributed, the full stack to be distributed around the globe. And they want global, you know, uptake on all of that. And so there's a push in pillar three on how to do that and to make sure that security wise, we're doing that well, and that, you know, they push money into making sure that these things are more secure. Here's where the rub comes in with this, this action plan that I'm not sure. I'm still digesting why or how this is going to work. Pillar one is about innovation and adoption. And right out of the gate, the first couple of bullets in pillar one are about making foundation models have free speech and removing from the NIST AI risk management framework the word misinformation. So in other words, they don't want the foundation models to worry about having misinformation, and they want them to not be woke. And so they just want them to be able to have free speech. And a translation for me is, oh my, what are they going to do? Are they going to go grok on us and say things maybe we don't want them to say? So when I go back to a global perspective, Sanjay, I want to know, how does that square with the EU AI Act and these other global, you know, laws? Like, from a procurement perspective, as that comes through my doorway, I'm thinking that's not going to pass muster. I'm not going to adopt that. It's too risky. So that's sort of a very high level where we're at right now.
A very high level floor that opens up to a few questions. Kerry, obviously it's pretty fresh off the press. So a lot of it has to be, you know, your perspective on it. You mentioned the EU AI Act, and companies that are global have to deal with, you know, different regions. They don't operate in one region per se. And we have a lot of our listeners who are with companies or run those kinds of companies. There's the EU AI Act, and then there are several other things, whether it's in Asia, Africa, China, etc. When you look what came by, you talked about, you know, the first part, infrastructure, obviously, as you said, everybody wants to be number one in AI. We are going to be number one, etc. But when you look in comparing this, and we people talk about how do we harmonize it or how do we make sure we don't have to do this, how does it compare? Let's take first with the EU AI Act.
How does the AI action plan compare to the EU AI Act?
Yeah.
I mean, it is not, the EU AI Act is a risk aware piece of legislation. There are requirements and consequences for not following requirements. This is an action plan. It is not set in law yet. It's not even a regulation. Right. It is a voluntary kind of a notional directional piece right now. There is a lot of policy direction in there of where he wants everyone to head and where laws should be made. But it is not rooted in risk awareness other than the security piece. There's a lot of security awareness in that. But certainly not for bias mitigation and those other things that we've been talking about for a long time.
So, as you said, if you're a company, what is the overall perspective that, hey, just innovate and not worry about things? Is that the message generally?
That's, yeah. Well, expedite. Hurry up and innovate, and we'll worry about the other stuff later. Yeah. Which I personally don't think that's sustainable. I mean, I think that's just a recipe for putting cars on the roads with no seatbelts, no airbags, no, you know, just no brake pedals. No, like, I worry about that.
And some of it is, there's a geopolitical dimension, as you know, Kerry, since now we are talking, because the message that is coming out from the White House, as well as from a lot of other people. We have a lot of members of Congress, Senate, governors, et cetera, who come on our show, is that this has national security, it has economic, political implications with this transformative technology. We cannot afford to be left behind in with some other countries who might not share our values. So we can't have regulation at this stage of the technology that will pull us back. What do you think? What is your perspective on that?
I agree. I was always, so we often talk about, should we regulate or not? Does AI require, is it special? Does it need special regulation? And so part of me was always like, well, you know, we have laws for not discriminating. We have the laws about, you know, unfair and deceptive practices. And we have some protections. So this isn't, you know, a new territory entirely. But even in what was published, starts to claw back some of that stuff. There are directives in there that says, go review those things. And if they're getting in the way of innovation, pull them back. So with those things being pulled back, now I actually am more and more concerned, actually. And so that's where this has always been part of my procurement kind of obsession. Because there is one area where, as a company, you get to decide what gets in your doors, and that is procurement. And if you don't want the bad stuff to come in, then you catch it at procurement.
Don't want the bad stuff to come in to catch it at procurement. We're going to get to that. But just given the timing of this issue, do you think the stakes of this technology are so monumental that we should put some of the safeguards that we inherently have had, as a lot of members of Congress come in and say, hey, Sanjay, we already have rules against discrimination, whether it's in housing, whether it's in employment. We have a Department of Labor, we have Equal Opportunity Commission, we have the FTC, we have the FDA for monitoring all this. But given, so to speak, the stakes that a lot of the foundation company people say that national security, is there a choice that we should make, in your view?
I mean, the stakes are high in some cases, education, health, utility, you know, like there are in some cases. One of the confounding things we all keep running into here in the U.S., I think other countries are more consistent. We have a level of inconsistency. So, for example, in the action plan, it says we want to promote open source and open weights. I love that. That's great. That's very important. There's some risks with it, but that's fine. In the very next executive order, it talks about you can do open source, but you really don't have to give away proprietary information. What's that?
I'm probably talking about weights and stuff like that.
Yeah, but it says promote open weights, but don't give them away. It. Well, what do you think open weights is? Like, I don't. So there's just inconsistency. So it's so difficult to answer questions when the common sense and the logic are like just scrambled sometimes.
Okay, well, we'll maybe try to move from a scrambled egg to maybe an omelet. a few weeks ago, as you know, we had this big, beautiful bill in Washington, D.C., and there was a provision in that bill that there would be a 10-year moratorium on states not being allowed to do AI legislation, because if every state, 50 states had different legislation, it would hinder innovation, et cetera, et cetera. You came out pretty strongly against that. And this comes back again to that question of innovation versus regulation. That's the kind of dilemma we are going through in our country right now. Why were you against that provision, Carrie?
First of all, the moratorium is back. It is squarely in the action plan again. The action plan calls for a review of state regulations that may get in the way of federal government. And it also calls for no funding to go to states that are doing that sort of regulatory behavior. So it's back just under a different name. I am against it because states are sovereign entities in that there are things that they have to take care of for themselves. They have to be able to run their school systems. They have to be able to run their traffic lights. They have to be able to run their emergency response vehicles and systems. And AI shows up in all of those areas. I was talking to someone that put AI detectors on their trash trucks to detect potholes. That's great, but it also started picking up homeless camps. Like, you know, we have to let states do what they can do without penalizing them. Like, I think they should be allowed to do that without the government, the federal, saying, don't do anything.
So, but let's just take, if there are 50 states and there are, you know, 10 of them that form legislation or regulation that, you know, is important to them. And you have companies, especially small companies, that are now kind of forced to comply with them. And some of these states could have, do you think that would hinder innovation in any way? Because that's the argument that is being made right now.
It is the argument. And so the exercise that we ran, I'm a member of the of IEEE's AI Policy Committee, and we put a group of us, probably about 30 of us together, and we said, what is this question we keep struggling with? Innovation versus regulation. When is it appropriate? And what we ended up coming up with was a spectrum of when it's appropriate. And the more irreversible the harm is, the more it's appropriate to regulate. The less it can be, you know, the more you can reverse it, you shouldn't have to regulate it. So in other words, irreversible means death, right? You can't come back from that. All right, we should pay attention. That's weapons. That's car deaths. That's things that physically harm people. If it means that your SNAP benefits are going to go away and you can't eat. Okay, so we're moving down the spectrum a little bit, but that's still difficult to reverse. It takes a long time to reverse. It might affect a lot of people. So there should be some regulation there. And so you move on down the spectrum to, I'm just filling Coke bottles in a manufacturing facility. We're okay. I don't think I need to regulate that part of it. You know, so that's the spectrum we want to work on.
Not trying to beat this topic to death, but just to final question, because I have guests who come here and point to the EU. Obviously, a lot of people point to the European Union as a great example, but they also point, a lot of members of Congress have said, we don't want to be the European Union. When was the last time they had X kind of a company? You know, look at the state of innovation, etc. There, in fact, a lot of European companies are coming here. So what do you say to that?
Yeah, well, I'm a risk manager at heart, so I'm moving to the EU. Well, I think, first of all, you have to start somewhere and you have to figure out what's working, what's not working. I think there should be allowances for a maturity scale and a curve to come, you know, for people to come along that curve. I think there should be some grace and leniency and some mentorship allowances. I think the EU went very far. The pendulum swung very far. I think that's an end state. And I think they know that. And I think they're kind of coming back a little bit from that. And I think that's great and fine. I like where Colorado landed. Their transparency is involved, and let's just check this with an impact assessment and kind of a little bit of a lighter duty. So the truth is in the middle, I would say, probably for a lot of that stuff.
Okay, so somewhere in the middle is what you're saying. Okay, let's talk about something that you are most passionate about. You have dedicated, and that's part of the reason we are having this conversation, because procurement of AI systems is a very, very important, critical topic, and you're going to tell us why. And you've dedicated a significant effort, Kerry, to AI procurement practices. Why did you choose, you know, to focus on them for as a lever for AI governance? You know, you could look at other approaches, whether it's algorithmic auditing or post-deployment monitoring, etc. Tell our audience, why is this so important?
To me, it is the gate of all gates. So when I think of AI governance, it's people, policies, and processes. That's generally governance. That's how the Oxford Handbook on Governance defines governance. And so your people is a strategy, right? Getting them ready, making sure they're trained, all that stuff. Your policies are a strategy. And you want to make sure that you know what your principles are, that you're following, and things like that. But where the rubber meets the road, it is right there at procurement. That is pen to paper. What do I want? What do I need? How do I want it? How do I need it? What are you going to give me? What am I going to give you? So procurement to me is like the head of the snake, and I just can't look away from it. It defines, you know, you set the expectations at that moment. You set your risk, you identify your risks, you assess your risks, you set your risk controls there, and that sets the stage for how you manage. So that's why it's important to me.
Head of the snake. I don't know if CIOs and CTOs have been thinking of snakes when they've been buying AI systems, but so we have a lot of CIOs that we have on our show, CTOs, chief AI officers. So they're all wondering, Kerry, why, what do they need to do differently when they're buying AI systems compared to, you know, other, you know, SaaS solution or other IT solutions? What's so different? Tell them.
Well, I think we all know that AI is it's not a deterministic system. It's not a rule-based system. It's not going to just do what you tell it to do. It's going to be a little amorphous. It's a little operating on its own sometimes, especially when you get into agents. And so understanding all of the elements of where it could go off the rails, and that risk assessment is the absolute most important part. So what I've studied most is where in that procurement process, in the procurement life cycle, do you have the opportunity to identify a risk and start to capture the opportunity to mitigate and control? And so that happens when you start to identify the need. It happens when you write a tender or a solicitation. That's a big tool for you. During your assessment of vendor evaluations and, you know, what they're offering you, especially during your contract, and then beyond when you do your, you know, the contract doesn't end, or the procurement doesn't end when you sign a contract. The contract lives on, you know, until you're ready to sunset. So that entire process is I call it the procurement apparatus. So your procurement apparatus is one of your best AI governance tools. It's when you operationalize. It all goes into there. And so there should be many people involved, right? It should be program managers or business owners and the procurement person and legal and your CISO and the people that are monitoring the metrics when it's, you know, once you sign and so on and so forth.
Do you think, you know, you said it's different than, let's say, traditional IT, tech, software, SaaS systems. Do you think the procurement or contract administrators for companies need some refresher training on how to buy AI systems?
Yes. Yeah.
Why is that?
Because we call it augmented procurement. So you're going to augment your practices where the risks are going to show up for AI. So you're not going to change your entire procurement process. You still have to go get your money and make sure you have the authority and do your market research. And a lot of things stay the same. But at certain points, you have to do a few extra things because the risks are more extensive or different. And you have to assess them and control them in a different way. than you would just a normal IT system or a traditional one.
And you also said get your legal and compliance on the other people involved. Kerry, we all know, I mean, at least most people know that AI systems, chatbots, other agents and other stuff, and we'll come to some of those topics, your favorite topics later on, have the potential, and these companies clearly lay out to either hallucinate or, you know, give answers that might not be appropriate, that has a challenge. How should companies during the procurement process account for those kinds of things? Because these vendors are saying, I mean, if you go to ChatGPT or Claude, or anything, it clearly says at the bottom, there's a disclaimer, let the buyer beware.
Yeah, right. So the way we suggest handling that is in your contract. Well, first of all, you write it into your solicitation, what your expectations are with respect to how frequently that would happen, metrics, you know, to measure that, and how many hallucinations you're going to allow in a certain period of time, or the types of hallucinations you will or won't allow. So that's why your solicitation or your tender is one of your best friends in that whole process. But from a contract perspective, there should be standard clauses. You want to know what the purpose of the solution is and the intent and intentional misuses and things like that. But to do a rider or a schedule attached, an addendum to the contract that lists out not just your business objectives or your business metrics, you know, I'm going to, uptime is going to be this, and it's going to accomplish these, you know, my inventory is going to be 30% less and things like that. But the AI metrics, my F1 score should be this, you know, it should not have more than X hallucinations. I'm going to monitor for incidents in this way. And then on top of that, you identify your breach patterns of behavior. So if you get close to breaching one of these AI metrics, you have to decide, I'm 80% within that metric. I want to pause the system. Probably not. But I do want the engineers to look at it, and I want them to give me a new mitigation. I'm 90% within. I want a manager involved now, and I want the engineers to give me a different mitigation. I'm 110% of that metric. I am going to press pause. I want the leaders involved. We got a big issue, you know, so don't wait till you're at 110%. Write that into the contract so everybody's on the same page and we don't have a fire drill.
That's a great point, but let me just ask you, there are 3 or 4 major vendors, at least right now, of foundation models. You know, take the other small open source vendors separately and we'll discuss that. Let's just assume most of them have the same clauses and they basically say, Kerry, you want our product? Here it is. No changes, no exceptions to this contract. And there are 3 of these vendors, and it is a technology that you kind of want. So what should a company do?
All right. So there are variables here. One of the variables is directly contracting with a foundation model. And then you're going to come in and bring that in and build bespoke models with it. That's a whole different scenario. So your procurement is for a, you know, that direct foundation model, as opposed to a procurement where you're buying something that another company has fine-tuned and is now selling you. This is your sales tool. It's going to listen to all your conversations. It's going to give you recommendations. This is your customer care tool. It's going to tell you if you're happy or sad on your call. It's going to take notes for you. So I'm more in the middle of the, they've used a foundation model and now they've fine-tuned it. So they're more accountable for what they've done for fine-tuning and things like that. However, on that foundation model scenario, you can still do that as an interdepartmental solution to set yourself up to say, these are going to be my metrics. This is what I'm going to do. If your engineers are here and they're doing that for a separate department, then that interdepartmental agreement should be established. Whose data is what? What happens to that data in the end? Are you allowed to have that data? I mean, all that sharing should be concretized in an agreement.
So that should be interdepartmental. That's a very good point. Mm-hmm. Carrie, just we'll come back to the main topic here. It just you said something that made me think. When cybersecurity, you know, hacks and everything else and ransomware became a big, big issue, you started to see cyber insurance start coming into play in a big way. Now companies can buy that. And maybe this is the case, and I don't know. Is AI insurance also a possibility in terms of procurement and things of that nature? If not, then some of our listeners who are entrepreneurs jump into it because there could be opportunity. I'm asking you, Carrie, is that a possibility too?
I mean, I'm seeing more exempting than I am insuring. In other words, saying, we're not covering that. No. That's not a thing for us. No, that's on you. I think what I would love to see insurance agencies do is to say, look, if you have a reasonable and robust AI governance process and policy in place, I'm seeing you train your people and be responsible with how you're buying your AI, and you can show me your contract terms and you know, put some due diligence to it. We won't raise your general liability policy. I think that's a possibility in the future, but I'm not seeing a lot of insurance companies jump into the insuring your AI products or giving you any kind of AI insurance at this point.
Yet.
Not yet.
I think it'll
be astronomical. Yeah.
Yeah. Gary, a few minutes ago, you mentioned don't let the bad stuff in. You know, which is kind of like a core principle for you.
Yeah.
And then also you mentioned before that there are some AI vendors who might not be as ethical and as responsible and could be selling AI snake oil. How can procurement teams distinguish between different kind of vendors?
Yeah, sometimes when we do procurement, we will do attestation procurement, where we just say, can you attest to that you have this in place or that your governance staff has this kind of experience? And so you just have them attest. Another way to do it would be show me the money. Okay, so I would like to see their resume. I would like to see your last quarter's test results for your F1 score and your bias metrics and your, you know, X, Y, and Z. So can you show me that? Better yet, if they come with a third party that's done that outside of them, and that third party is credible and they've signed off as an independent, you know, non-conflicted party, now you're really talking about something that is trustworthy. So those are the kinds of measures you kind of want to see what they're working with your own eyes, not just an attestation or a marketing, you know, brochure or something like that. And then the third line of defense is a pilot with stakeholders involved and really listening, you know, to those stakeholders.
You know, have a pilot and, you know, get the stakeholders involved.
Yeah.
Gary, there's already substantial guidance for AI. Well, I wouldn't say substantial, but there's some guidance for AI procurement. You know, the World Economic Forum has this procurement in a box. UK government has a guideline for AI procurement, and the National AI Advisory Committee's recommendations. What do you see as the strengths and weaknesses of some of these existing frameworks?
Yeah, they all cover great sets of questions. Mm-hmm. Like they all have, these are things you should ask vendors. And they're accurate. Those are all things you should ask vendors. The weakness I find in a lot of them is they don't go much too much further beyond that. So in other words, if you're still coming along the maturity curve and your skills are still building for AI, which is a lot of procurement, I mean, we're still learning a lot. You might not know why you're asking, what is the traceability of your data? Or what is an F1 score? Maybe you don't know what those questions are even asking. And what these other frameworks lack is telling you why you're even asking that. And then further, what's a good answer and what's a bad answer? So you can evaluate and measure, this vendor was good and this one wasn't, and I'll give this one a 10 and this one gets an 8. So those are, again, they're all great questions, but a little problematic because you have to have so much knowledge to understand a little more depth behind that. I was the vice chair on IEEE 3119. It's now published. It's 3119:2025. And we added rubrics. So we have lots of good questions too. But we did add the explanation of why you're asking and provided rubrics to say, this is good, this is bad. Yeah. So that's a little more helpful. But there's obviously IEEE likes to make money on their standards. So, but it's only like $125. So that's pretty available cool. Now.
You also, Carrie, said that procurement is where AI governance moves from strategy to, you know, operation. What are some of the first three checkpoints that every company or agency should hit before they issue an AI RFP?
Yeah, I mean, that's just it's a great question, because I feel like, first of all, what I'm seeing in this space, I don't know if you hear people talking about this, but what we see a lot of is the vendor shows up, knocks on the door, says, I have a cool thing. You really need it because it's going to save you money, save you time, whatever. And then you're salivating, and then you pilot it. And then next thing you know, you've adopted it. So resisting that urge, what you would commonly should do is find a business problem that you really actually need to solve and really dissect that, because that will tell you, did you just need to fire someone or do you really need AI? And if you really need AI, how's that data going to come into that system? Because is it good or not good? So that's like one really important thing. Another one, every governance framework will tell you to do an impact assessment, and you should, because everything on that impact assessment ends up usually feeding into the tender statement. And then lastly, the tender statement and how you write up that work, how you describe it. Preferably you would do a performance-based contract. So you know, you're kind of working with that vendor. It's a two-way street. Don't be unreasonable. No one's that mature. You got to work with them. But that tender statement can be your golden goose of getting what you need and what that vendor needs from you.
So the tender statement, I think you're saying, is a very, very critical aspect, Carrie, for doing this.
Yeah.
Carrie, there is this concept of sovereign AI. When you listen to Jensen Huang at NVIDIA, he says every country should have its own AI. Mm-hmm. Now, Sam Altman, OpenAI, I think, has got something called a sovereign AI. There are countries that are looking... Well, every country wants to have AI in some shape or form. Nobody wants to, as you said, everybody wants to be number one, or in some cases, they just want to be a number. And the BRICS nations recently, they issued their own AI governance statement. From a procurement or governance standpoint, especially for countries around the world, when you look at the Global South and others, how can they make sure that the things that you just talked about from a procurement standpoint, and that talks about their data sovereignty and, privacy, as well as in many cases, cultural identity and things of that nature, those things are taken care of, because we have a global audience. It's not just Delaware and Washington, D.C., which is where we cover. But so just for them, what would be your message for some of them?
So we were just talking about the couple of things that you get started with when you're doing a procurement, that impact assessment and the solicitation. I'm going to marry that with the fact that you shouldn't be doing this alone. This is a team sport. And so when you do an impact assessment and when you do that, that tender, you should have more people at the table than just a procurement person. And so when you have more voices, they can bring in, wait a minute, we need to be culturally sensitive because the system is going to impact these kinds of people. Wait a minute, the law just changed. Wait a minute, we need to think about how this is going to impact, you know, over here. And so when you do that, you just end up with totally better outcomes. The process didn't change. You still buy the way you buy. You got to go get the money. You got to do the market research. You got to do these steps. It's just the people will put into that coffee grinder, so to speak. Do you want dark roast today? Do you want light roast? Is it, you know, it's the people in the process that really make it, you know, the flavor that you need it to be for wherever you're at in the world.
So the process is the same. It just, some of the circumstances change. That's a good point for our global listeners. Gary, let's talk about a topic which is the flavor of the month, the week, the year, which is agents and agentic AI. That's a topic that comes up all the time right now. You have expressed concerns, and I've had a few guests that have come in who are chief AI officers of some of the largest cybersecurity companies, but they have different kinds of concerns. But what are your concerns, and what should organizations consider before deploying agentic AI system? And I can tell you, every company either is deploying it or is looking, at least major companies looking at deploying it. So tell them what is keeping you up at night about these millions of digital workers out there, and what should they be considering?
Yeah, I don't know that my security concerns would be any different than any of your, you know, CISOs or anybody else like that that comes through the door. I mean, OWASP has done a great job highlighting a lot of the things that are of concern on that front. That's a lot of it. And so when I couple that with knowing where the literacy level is of procurement, I get really nervous. Because not only do you have to, in procurement, do you have to understand just general principles of AI and ask where's the data coming from and, you know, the whole value chain. Now you have to layer on this linkage and this compounding complex network of agents talking to other agents and tools and APIs and all of these other things with vulnerabilities for security. Put that in a box for a second. I'm going to go back to my strategic planner hat that I used to wear 20 years ago when we were just doing straight up ERP system design. When you brought an ERP system in, one of the banes of the existence of doing that was to map processes every day. That's all you're doing is mapping process.
We used to call it BPR, by the way.
Yes. It's just like, I never found a process that was like, perfect. Never. And so when I think of agents, like just, let it do it. You know, it'll figure it out. Like, what process are you talking about that runs normal and smooth every time? Like, I don't know, where are you on drugs? Like, I don't know what you're talking about. So I feel like one of the big missing elements in agents is the domain professional that understands the workflow well enough to be able to help actually train those domain agents. So they might work in low stakes and for low stakes tasks that are simple, you know, maybe single turn or very few turn tasks. But when you get into more complex multi-turn tasks, I am just like, whoa, we don't have the talent and skill sets on the domain side. Maybe on the IT tech side, but not on the domain side, to help couple bring together and make those agents actually work the way you want them to. And then you got to solve for the security part on top of that. That's where I'm coming from with it.
Well, that leads to a zillion questions I have, but see if we can pare it down. Or I might need a few agents to kind of ask you those questions. But let me give you an example. I had the chief AI officer of, I would say, one of the largest employment companies in the world. They've got, at least over 1 million employees or so. It's one of the largest staffing companies in the world. And I thought it was pretty fascinating. He says, everybody who joins the company, I mean, their intention is going to have an agent that will follow them through their career. Okay? So it's a pretty cool thing. It stays with you, et cetera. Now, I'm going to turn to you from a procurement standpoint. And then I've had some of the leading leaders of some of the leading vendors of AI agents. And they've said, we are working on innovative pricing mechanisms. So I'm going to add that wrinkle. We're going to do outcome-based pricing. We might do replacement employee pricing. So how are these folks, I mean, you're a procurement guru. How are companies currently buying agents or whatever you want to software or digital, as some of these people said, they are digital workers that report to HR. And I'm so explain to me, because I am trying to figure out if it's outcome-based pricing, who's responsible for the outcome or the consequences of the outcome. So walk our audience as the procurement for some of these things. How are contracts going to be written for outcome-based pricing? Or in some cases, it's replacement employee pricing, they said, too.
Yeah, Sanjay, this is not going through procurement. This is pilot test stuff. It's kind of like when OpenAI went to, I can't think of their name. It's just not going through procurement. It's going straight to the CTO, the CIO saying, I've got a great idea. You want to come along and pilot test it. You'll be the first ones. We'll try it together. This is not a mainstream scenario yet.
You mean agents are not
being agents are, but that type of pricing model.
The pricing, okay.
Yeah.
So let's say the pricing is not being deployed, but
right.
Who are agents supposed to report to, Kerry?
Yeah, that's the problem.
I'm asking you as a procurement or a contract, who are these people reporting to, these digital workers or whatever you want to call them? Who are they reporting to?
That is the problem. Every time I start trying to ask this question, the people recoil and they're like, well, actually, our pilot didn't go well and we just didn't. So they're really piloting. I'm not finding a lot of official, we're up and running, it's an official program, we've got 30,000 of them. Like, I'm just not finding that anywhere. I'm not finding it. So maybe they exist, but I feel like that's a hype that's not quite mainstream yet. I don't know where these people are that are just running rampant with agents all over their, because of these things, like, they have major security issues and they don't actually know how to do workflows. So they quickly die in the pilot stage.
Every one of them says, hey, we are either looking at it or we are deploying it.
Early
stage, yes. But I mean, if you listen to, leaders of foundation companies or others, Salesforce, for example, they've got Agentforce and other stuff.
Yeah.
So it's a key part of what they're doing. And if I am a client buying, let's just say, Agentforce, and there's many other things, there's ServiceNow and many, many others. So What should procurement be looking at, Kerry? If you were on the procurement side, what would you suggest to them?
So,
because it's coming, whether
it is
it is absolutely coming. There's just no question that it is coming.
Yeah, and you're right. Salesforce and ServiceNow are two great examples. That still, I don't know that they're going through procurement because those are existing, you know, solutions that bolt on their AI. And then I get a lot of those questions. I have a contract. Now my vendor just told me they have AI. What do I do? And so that's a great example of one. But the only answer is upskilling. I mean, you just have to continue to train and learn. So at the AI Procurement Lab, that's what we're doing, is building out those courses and what do you need to know and how do you evaluate them? And so there's some leaderboards that, you know, they spiral out of control every 6 months and you got to find the next one that's evaluating how to evaluate agents. And you listen to peers and you listen to the leaders. And yeah, it's agents are very, very hard. They're just, I don't know that we have our hands around agents from a procurement perspective. There's so many security issues. I need the CISOs involved in anything that you're going to do with agents. I'm just so nervous about them.
But is someone looking at it because it's something folks like you have to take the lead and deal with it, because whether they are bolting on to existing contracts or companies selling it as a separate, it's coming. I mean, I can tell you it is just because nobody, remember, it's the FOMO. No company wants to be left behind here.
Yeah. And I can't tell if it is here or not here. Again, that's what I'm trying to say. I hear a lot of, we're testing it, we're rolling it out, but it's very early stages and nothing seems to stick. Like, I'm not hearing, and our agents doing well. I'm hearing, and it failed. And so we'll try something else. In fact, with ChatGPT, just the other day when they rolled out GPT Agent, my first reaction was to go back to everybody I know, every group and club and client that I have all around, and say, first of all, go back to your AI use policy and start recrafting it. Go to your IT team and start telling them to test it. And go to your users and tell them, don't touch anything until I tell you you can touch something. It's kind of like when you have Salesforce and they give you that, you can go to the library and start adding on, you know, apps and things. A lot of companies don't just let you just add on stuff. You know, that's what it felt like was happening. I don't want ChatGPT agents scrolling through my Gmail. Not a good idea. You know, so let's pause. So agents are, we don't have good answers for them. I don't even get procurement people that understand general AI stuff, let alone how can I tell them what a multi-turn agent is and what tools they're calling. We're at early stages of literacy on a lot of this stuff. Yeah.
Wow.
So I know they're not going through procurement. They're just not.
Not going through procurement. I'm going to ask that question next time, which will happen pretty soon, the CIO, et cetera, and ask them, where is it going through in terms of the buying process? Kerry, just the last question on agent is, if let's just say a company is implementing the agent, and let's say the agent in its, because the agent has autonomy, at least some agents have autonomy in terms of actions. Autonomous agents can take action on their own. So let's just say there is an accident through the actions of an agent. Where is the liability here in that kind of a process? You're a contract. You're not a lawyer, I understand, but where is the liability here?
Yeah, because it's not going through procurement, I don't believe we have good answers for this right now. I mean, in a contracted situation, you would know who's liable for what. You would have people in charge. You would have, in other words, you would have roles and responsibilities established in a good governance oversight situation. With some of these scenarios, they just feel very mercurial, very sort of haphazard in certain ways. So when they're piloted scenarios, I'm not sure. I know there's an organization I work with right now. They don't have incident management set up. They just didn't think of it. They're like, well, so I guess if something happens, they'll just call me. But they don't outright say that's what you need to do. That's what you should do. It's just, I don't know, maybe they'll just let me know if something. So I just don't think that there's a maturity of governance as strongly as you're asking for. Now, maybe there is with some of the organizations you're speaking to, but I work a lot with the lower end of large and into medium sized companies, and they're just not, they're not there. There's gaps.
Are procurement organizations that you know of, are they talking about this kind of a topic in your view?
Yeah. But here's the problem. They're talking about this. They're talking about sustainable procurement. And they're talking about other priorities that are given to them from on high. So, you know, got to save money. Oh, my headcount's going to be reduced because. So this is like one of 5 or 10 things that they're, you know, worried about. So it's just put it on the list. We'll get to it.
Put it on the list.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I could go on and on, but there's one other question I kind of wanted to talk to, which is also a very topical thing. And you have talked about this also, which is synthetic data.
Oh.
And you've said it can be beneficial and it can be risky. Mm-hmm. How should organizations, you know, approach synthetic data in their AI strategies? Now, keep in mind, a lot of foundation companies are now using synthetic data to train their models, etc. And so what is your concern about synthetic data?
Well, okay, so let me use an HR solution as a starting point for the discussion. When we have resume data, we may say, well, it's just I didn't have enough of it, so I want more of it. So you would say, well, easily I'll just go get synthetic data or I'll make synthetic data. And that may be okay. However, data principles still apply. And so sometimes what in the research that I was looking at, you would have, you know, just sort of a novice data scientist fresh out of school. They hadn't really done much data projects on their end. And they just think, I'll just copy and paste and that's good enough. And then they don't do the robustness reviews and they don't do the, you know, the bias reviews and things like that. But that just gets sucked up into the model and it, you know, comes out the other end the way it comes out. So in that case, synthetic data was a really bad idea. But if you use it in a way that you are applying all of your good data cleansing and you know, monitoring and bias checking and all of your robustness stuff, then it can be a good use, a good way to make sure you get more representativeness inside of your models and things like that. Now, for big foundation models, to use synthetic data for replicating website data and things like that, I don't know about that. The studies were a little light duty on that side. I think we have a problem with recursive information right now. And I don't think we are going to get a clear view on what synthetic data looks like going back into those recursive, you know, kind of that scenario. But in other isolated cases, you can see where it could be good or bad, depending on the talent using it.
So if you have safeguards and if you have the right talent using it, it could be. Because in some cases, Gary, talking to, you know, the experts or the users, in some cases, like in healthcare and others, they don't have a choice but to use this synthetic data.
Yeah.
Because there is, you know, a lot of privacy and other issues that they deal with. So we'll see how things go. Kerry, I could go on and on and on. We'll have to do part two. But for our TikTok kind of listeners, we do have at the end a lightning round of questions for you. We need one word answers. So are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. And we'll try to keep it focused on the procurement side, even though
sure,
I think you can handle it all. So, Kerry, AI procurement, centralized or distributed decision-making?
Yes.
No, you have to pick one, centralized or distributed. Pick one of them.
That's not fair because you have to tell me what type of a business or what size of a business it is.
So it depends is what you're saying.
It depends on the size of your business. Obviously, if you're large, you need distributed. If you're smaller, okay, you need centralized.
Okay, I'm going to give you an easy one. And okay, you could probably use an old President Reagan phrase. So vendor AI claims, trust or verify?
Verify.
Okay. AI contract terms, Gary, standard or customized?
Customized.
Okay. Post deployment changes, vendor flexibility or strict controls?
Vendor flexibility.
Okay. This one is an interesting one for you. So for AI procurement expertise, should you build it internally or hire externally? Build or hire?
It depends on the size of the company.
Okay. Risk management, prevention or mitigation?
Mitigation.
Okay. AI standards, voluntary or mandatory compliance?
That's a both.
Okay. This is an interesting one. You kind of touched on this. Future procurement, is it going to be human-led or AI assisted?
AI assisted.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This one, I think I'm glad we'll give you an easy one. Open source AI models, is it an opportunity or a risk?
Opportunity.
Okay. Data for AI training, consent or fair use?
Consent.
Okay. We lost two interesting ones. Most overrated AI risk word, hallucination or alignment?
Alignment.
And the best verb for AI governance, audit, assure, or operationalize?
The operationalize.
Okay. Kerry, thank you so much, really, for sharing your insights. As I said, we covered the new announcements from the Trump administration, we covered procurement, we covered agents, synthetic data, and we could have gone on and on, you know, because you have the tremendous intersection of, you know, AI governance and also practical implementation, which gives you really a unique perspective. And, you know, to our listeners, Kerry's approach tells us that effective AI governance isn't just about creating the right policies. It's about her favorite word of operationalizing them through practical mechanisms like procurement training and organizational change management. And also one of her other favorite words, don't let the bad stuff in, is in a thoughtful acquisition practice, which offers you a concrete path. This is the Regulating AI Podcast. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri. Until next time, keep advocating for AI that serves humanity's best interest. Thank you for listening.